This is KUOW's The Record, Thursday, June 30th. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. It is one of the last remaining bans on military service, and it's being dropped. Today, the Pentagon said transgender people will be allowed to serve openly in the U.S. military. Today's news prompts us to call up a soldier we first introduced to you last fall. Captain Jennifer Peace is an intelligence officer stationed here at Joint Base Lewis-McChord near Tacoma. Captain, welcome. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you.
You began your transition to being a woman after having served in the Army for years. I wonder, how does this change your life?
Yeah, this was it was a big day. I've been given the opportunity in the command that I serve in to serve as a female and as my target gender, but it's still been skirting the edge of policy and working with my commander and not under any official regulation. So today I can officially change my gender in years with the new policy, and there's no more concern that I could move to a new unit and suddenly my identity is taken away again by a different commander. So this is just an amazing moment, not only for myself, but for all the trans service members who have been unable to come out and serve as their target gender within their commands.
You say that you've been skirting the edge of gender officially. Will you give us some examples of that? The Army lets you stay in, but not officially as a woman.
Right. So they put out that the discharges for being transgender were going to be elevated up to the Pentagon about a year ago. So it was very difficult for any trans service members to be discharged, and I don't believe that any were. But the regulations in place to guide your uniforms, your grooming standards, your appearance, pronouns, and everything else haven't existed in place. And the command that I have been in has been extremely supportive, but so many others haven't, or they've been strictly adhering to current policy because they were unsure of what they should be doing. So going forward, it sounds like they're going to be publishing some guidelines for commanders in order to treat transgender soldiers just like all other soldiers in the military.
Yes, it sounds like a lot of what you've gone through is going to be changing. You had your name legally changed, but your soldiers were under orders to address you as sir.
That's true. I was given counseling statements from my leadership, as were other soldiers, not only that they should address me with male pronouns, but that I should go around correcting anyone who used female pronouns. And it was, I don't think any of it was done maliciously, but we were existing, you know, where the military thrives on regulations and rules, and those did not exist. So commanders were having to use their best judgment to navigate through a lack of policy. And I think now that all that's gone, service members will be able to be recognized as their gender identity.
Yes, your hair was too long. You were ordered to get it cut, and there are questions about bathrooms and bunks and, as you said, pronouns. What do you think will be the biggest challenges in implementing this change in policy we're talking about today?
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard work, but I don't think it's going to be difficult work. Once the policy is out there, commanders will adhere to it, and it's going to be a matter of people feeling comfortable enough to come out. Because when a soldier sees on the news that transgender service members are allowed to serve, the first thing that's going to come into their mind is this caricature of what being a transgender person means. They're going to imagine someone in high heels and over-the-top makeup, and they're not going to realize that they've been serving with a transgender soldier for years, maybe in combat. Maybe it's one of their closest friends who they don't know. But once it becomes not a transgender service member, but, oh, that's Captain Peace or Sergeant Forrest or whoever else. Once they know that person, then I think all that stigma, all those problems will dissipate very quickly.
We're talking with Army Intelligence Officer Captain Jennifer Peace, stationed here at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. She transitioned to being a woman beginning after she had deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. What did your wife, Debbie, say when she heard the news?
Today, I tried to call her so that we could listen to it together, and she was having to watch it on her phone. So as soon as it was over, I called her up, and we were both kind of crying at each other. Just, we've been through so much. There were so many difficult days where it would just shut you down, the fear of losing your job and your career and everything you worked for, and you just couldn't make it through the day. And all that being gone, I mean, it's just such a relief that there's still work to do, but that we can move on with our lives. And I can put being a trans service member way at the back of a list, because I just want to be first a mom and a wife and a soldier. And I feel like today I can start putting being transgender kind of at the back of the list instead of something I have to fight for every day.
Army Captain Jennifer Peace, it's good to talk with you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, the news today, the Pentagon says transgender people will be allowed to serve openly in the United States military. The Defense Secretary, Ash Carter, said transgender people who enlist will still have to meet the necessary standards and will have to have been stable in their identified gender for 18 months. We'll continue to cover this later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Stay with us. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. What an unpredictable presidential race it's been this year with some unusual candidates, which spells opportunity for comedians like Larry David as Bernie Sanders.
Let me tell you something. I've met some of these super delegates. They're not so super. Mediocre delegates is more like it.
But what about comedians here in Seattle, where around 80% of people typically vote for the Democratic presidential nominee? KUOW's David Hyde has the story.
The top two presidential candidates are pretty unpopular this year. The voters have given Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump some of the highest unfavorable ratings in decades. But a lot of comedians seem to be enjoying themselves, like Kate McKinnon as Hillary Clinton on Saturday Night Live.
Citizens, you will elect me. I will be your leader.
And there are so many Donald Trumps.
He's like a Batman villain to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll never get away with this, Trump.
You know, I think I will.
Although Dana Carvey does qualify his enthusiasm.
I mean, I'm not saying I want Donald Trump to be president,
yeah,
but I never want to live in a world where Donald Trump isn't running for president.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the national stage. What's happening here in Seattle? I'm at a place called Jai Tai on Capitol Hill where the comedians are hanging around waiting to go on. Billy Anderson's not a fan of the Trump joke. He says they don't always land the way you might expect.
You'd think Seattle would be a city full of people that'd be like, yeah, let's get rid of Trump, boo Trump. But they get a little uncomfortable when you try to force them to pick a political side in a room where they're not sure of it.
What's going on there? What's that all about?
I think people aren't used to conflict in this city. That's my opinion. I mean, compared to the southeastern part of the United States, which is like 110% conflict, I think people just don't want the argument. They don't want a direct confrontation. And so when you start trying to be like, yeah, that Trump guy should die, right? And they're like, does everybody agree with that? I don't know. I don't like that.
Most of the comedians on this Tuesday night, including Kristen Leonard, told me they avoid Trump and almost all presidential election humor.
Definitely. I grew up watching The Daily Show, have always been a big fan of that. I think I like political humor that addresses widespread issues as opposed to specific people more, because you know, people's spot in the limelight will come and go, whereas institutional problems like racism and sexism and homophobia, I feel like those are more worthy of addressing.
Annika Sela says there's no politics in her act, and definitely no Trump.
That's a hard one. Donald Trump is a hard person to make jokes about because he is a joke. Like, how do you make a joke out of something that does a perfectly good job of being a walking, talking parody?
Billy Anderson says, if you're going to try election humor, okay, but there's a right way and a wrong way.
If you're just trying to get an easy win by being like, boo, Trump, isn't he an idiot? Blah, tiny hands or whatever, then you might get some giggles. But if you talk about your own reasons for not liking Trump or your own reasons for having things, then you make it personal. People will laugh with you or they'll laugh at you or however you want to do it.
But pretty much all the comedians I spoke with in Seattle said they just didn't want to talk Trump. Abraham Tedessa sums it up.
This is what kills me, is we're talking about Trump and it's driving me insane. Even though I can't stop spewing it, I want to. I quit. I'm done talking about Trump.
Okay, so that's what the pros say. Which means if you need an election humor fix here in the Seattle area, you might need to hit up your friends or family. Or do what I did, ask random strangers around town to give you their best political impressions.
I make the best deals.
I'm winning. He's stupid.
Jeb is a big mistake. A big, fat mistake. I never work with him.
Amazing. It's going to be huge.
We're going to be huge.
Huge.
Huge. Huge. Really huge.
That's Dan Jort, Sean Vaughn, Brett, Alex, and Hillary Austin. And, well, in Seattle's University District, huge. It's huge. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Billionaire Paul Allen has donated $1 million to help house the homeless in Seattle. His money will help build 13 steel modules for homeless people to live in. Think shipping container-like structures with social services available on site. The Seattle company that makes those modules is called One Build. The founder is Dale Sperling, and he told me that using steel modules for housing is a quantum leap because it brings costs way down.
The only way we can solve this homelessness problem is to find ways to produce more housing for less capital cost. What we have right now is we have this huge gap between blue tarps and duct tape and sani cans and $300,000 per unit cost for an apartment in Seattle. So what we're saying is this is a solution that is transitional. It's in between blue tarps and duct tape and tents and full-on $300,000 apartment buildings in the city.
To the average listener, Dale, this sounds kind of obvious. You build small modular metal apartments. You could stack them like Legos or something. But you say it's a quantum leap. Why? Why has this not been done more widely before?
Well, and I can't answer why it hasn't been done in Seattle other than the fact that basically, there's been very little productivity increases in the construction industry in the last 50 or 60 years. If you take a look at every construction site, it's essentially the same way they did it 50 or 60 years ago. We're talking about building these in a factory where we condense the supply chain, where we do everything we can to drive efficiency into the manufacturing process. I mean, think about it. When you buy a car, they don't come out and build it in your backyard. They build it in a factory. They apply manufacturing processes, and that's never been done in the small-scale wood frame construction industry in the United States. It's done everywhere else in the world. It's just never been done in the U.S.
We're, of course, talking about a home, so what is it like to live inside?
These are absolutely code-compliant, everything about it. They're insulated, sound-insulated, temperature-insulated. You will not be able to tell the difference from a conventional apartment in Seattle. They'll be steel frame. They will be modular, as you said, stackable, but they will not be any different from a conventional apartment.
And if you're thinking cold metal box or rain drumming loudly on a roof, it's not that.
Not that. The roof will be insulated, soundproofed. You're not living in a tin can.
You're building 13 units with the money from Paul Allen. There are thousands of homeless people around here. How likely is it that your model could be scaled up to make a dent in the homelessness crisis?
That's the whole thesis here. The whole thesis is to do a pilot program, provide it all in one package, both the structure to live in as well as the wraparound services, the services that include all of the social services, all of the mental health services, all of the stuff that these homeless people need, and then scale it up and try to scale it up in a fashion where it's flexible. We don't have to do a 200-unit project to make this successful. It can be done on surplus sites, church sites, parking lots. This can make it a big dent. And I think that's the idea that Paul Allen got really excited about is this is a pilot program. Let's try it, see how it goes, and then scale it up.
And I know this is hard to pin down, but you imagine saving local taxpayers. Give me some idea how much, because it's a lot about money saving. So how much of a difference are we talking?
Today, to move someone from a tent to a low-income housing unit, not including any of the services, the capital cost alone is $280,000 to $300,000 per unit. That includes site costs, construction costs, architecture and engineering, design fees, contractor costs, all of that. We think we can build these modular units for probably 30 to 40% of that cost, well under $100,000 a unit. So if we can save $200,000 of capital cost per unit, we can fund more of the social services that are necessary.
Well, Paul Allen has $1 million easy. Is there? Do you want people listening to get involved somehow, or you just want the rest of us to wait and hopefully watch this scale up?
We're hopeful that there will be a lot of interest in this, and that, you know, call it crowdsourcing, call it public funding. You put your finger on it. Homelessness today, this is a huge problem, and this is, we think, an innovative solution that can make a real dent in this. And it will take more funding. It'll take a lot of funding. Paul Allen is incubating a pilot program. Let's see if it works. I mean, and I'll tell you, I think a structure that has a bed, has cooking facilities, has a bathroom and a shower versus a tent, this is the home.
Dale Sperling works in Seattle, but he talked to us on vacation there on his cell phone from Mount Lassen National Park out in California. He is the founder of One Build, talking to us about small spaces while he's in the great outdoors. One Build is the company that's working with the Compass Housing Alliance to build a new style of transitional housing. Billionaire Paul Allen has donated $1 million to help. And you're listening and learning about it here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Do our national parks have a problem with diversity? Because a National Park Service survey found that 78% of visitors to the parks were white. A Seattle woman is working to change that. Jordan Keith is the founder and director of the Urban Wilderness Works. For the past 13 years, she's been taking high school and college-age students of color on wilderness trips. Her kids spend 17 days in the North Cascades working on trails and learning leadership skills. A lot of them have never experienced wilderness before. Jordan Keith told me she was a lot like them when she was their age.
The first time I actually climbed up a significant mountain in Maine, and it just blew me completely away. That experience, I mean, I really experienced for a natural high. And I fell in love with it right away, being outside and these wide spaces, I think, is the difference.
How did the wide spaces change you?
I think I'd always felt very narrowed by the urban corridors in Philadelphia. I know that, but I couldn't name it. You're not limited by whatever it is, your experience of race or gender or sexual orientation. Those kind of things fall away with other people because you're focused on the stars. It's hard to explain. And it's also a part of it, too, that you're at this place where you're all suddenly together in a moment of looking at an unfathomable number of stars.
It sounds like you feel that everybody in the city deserves that unlimitedness.
I think everybody everywhere needs the opportunity to see if that's something that sparks who they are.
You've said that that it's hard, especially for people of color, to experience the wilderness, and not everybody will know, you know, has thought about that or knows why that is. Will you explain that?
Yes. Well, and being specific, I think when we say people of color, oftentimes people think African American people, but it's different for different people of color, depending on their experience. I think mostly because I identify as African American, the stories I heard or didn't hear, and how what I think of as the intersections of legacy that keep you from having access to wild places. So some of that access is being able to see yourself there. You've seen other people there who are like you. You've gone and you feel comfortable. So that's one type of access, just imagining that you can. The other access is also proximity is a real issue. And then, you know, there's what I recognize and others have as historical collective memory that has trauma because many violent acts occurred towards black people and pictures of it in, you know, in the woods. And even though the stories, those horror pictures of people being burned and lynched, that's a collective scar. There's images of that. That impacts the stories that people tell each other about what black people do or don't do.
Now you take young people into the wilderness. And what do you, first of all, where do you go? What do you do?
Urban Wilderness Works has been partnering with the North Cascades National Park for like 10 years. And we work to bring them up to Ross Lake, which is this beautiful part of the park. And we work with them to build trails, spend their first 10, 12 days volunteering. The youth are building trails, learning everything about how trails are constructed and erosion and the history of the place and all of these things. And then we go together on a backpacking trip or hike or just lay and make art and poems and paintings.
Why is working part of it? Why building trails?
So I feel like it's really important for people who may and probably never would associate with each other to be brought together by a mutual desire to go out into the wilderness and then have a project that they have to learn how to complete together. They have to set these goals and meet these benchmarks, and they learn how to communicate. Sometimes it means learning how to speak up when you're always the quiet one. Sometimes it means an instructor encourages you, don't be the person that always steps forward and help. Let someone else discover their own ability.
First of all, along the way, what are you teaching?
It's critical what we're teaching. So not only do we focus on the outdoor skills that are required, but also what's really important that we teach is people to slow down and the context of their lives in the context of that wild or wilder space than the neighborhood that they're in. So when we're looking at the stars again, you know, reminding people, yeah, you know, Harriet Tubman navigated her way and a lot of people's way to freedom by knowing that star that you're looking at. Our program is focused on bringing people, again, of different racial or rather ethnic heritages together. So, you know, we might have somebody, we might have African-American, Latino, Native American, all on the trip, kids of European descent on the trip, all with one desire to be out in the wilderness. But we don't carry the same stories. So you learn about each other. So that seems authentic to me. And it's harder than a homogenous experience where you assume everybody is on the same page. We teach people that. How do you have a discourse about something you don't necessarily agree on? What does respect for yourself and other people and the rest of the natural world around us look like on a day-to-day basis? And how do you support the person who might be falling behind or tell the person who always feels like they have to do everything for everybody that it's okay so that they can carry that back home?
So after a couple of weeks in the wilderness, how do you see young people change?
Their parents tell me because I give them back. Their parents tell me because all of a sudden they can manage what seemed unmanageable tasks, like knowing how to set the benchmarks to do the simplest thing from clean up their room to manage their applications for school to be confident that they are going to graduate. A lot of it manifests in the tenacity, because believe me, tenacity is required to be in the woods for 17 days with people you've never met from different cultures. You have to carry your water, cook your food, build the trail, carry your backpack.
Is there an example that comes to mind? A young person who changed out there?
It was the first trip, and it was hard. It was like day 16, and we were going to climb up a mountain. After they fought with me that they were tired and sore and they didn't want to go, we got around this switchback, and the kids started running up the hill because they were like, "Oh, Jordan, you can see everything." I was like, "Yeah, that's what I was trying to tell you, why we needed to leave earlier." So this young woman, we're sitting on the side of the cliff and we're looking at the rocks. And after we said, "Well, we're not going to go further than this," she says, looking at the rocks, "Why would God put that there if it wasn't for us to know to treat each other better?" I've never forgotten that. It made me cry. It still makes me cry. It's why I do what I do, because I feel like that's what everyone deserves. A chance to tap into spirit in a way that's not defined.
Jordan Keith takes high school and college-age students of color into the North Cascades for 17 days at a time as the director and founder of the Urban Wilderness Project. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us, learning right along with me today. Like you, I listen to KUOW, and I hear about the upheaval in Great Britain. I know their people voted to leave the European Union, and their prime minister was sorry he asked, and so he's quitting, and now the man that everyone thought was the front runner to be the new prime minister said he doesn't want to run. This baffles me a bit, maybe you too, so I called up a Seattle expat, Ian Toner, with the investment managing consulting firm Veris, based in Seattle. Hi, Ian.
Hi there. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for taking a few minutes and just helping us understand. Why do your politicians seem to not want the job of prime minister, even though they could have it?
I wouldn't call it that way.
Okay.
Cameron, the current prime minister, put his reputation on winning the vote to stay in the European Union, and it was going to be very tough for him to stay having lost it.
But how does that work? I mean, a reputation is a very vague thing, and it being tough for him, I don't understand why someone leaves such a prominent job for a reason like that.
So the answer is pretty simple. You're not elected prime minister directly. The prime minister is the person who can command a majority in the House of Commons.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it's kind of like Speaker of the House in some senses in American terms. And so he has to look behind him on those famous green benches when you see it on TV, and those are the people that vote for him. A good proportion of them voted leave. A good proportion of them didn't particularly like him in the first place. He's been in charge of the party for 10 years, so there's a variety of resentments built up in one way or another. So coming out of it, he will have turned around and looked behind himself and said, "I can't command the support of these people, and they're going to expect me to get into 2 years of fights with my former colleagues in the European Union negotiating on the way out, and I'm done." And you can understand why that's a reasonable train of thought for someone in his position.
Okay, that's getting more reasonable for me. Thank you. How about this London mayor who apparently everyone thought, oh, Boris Johnson, he's the front runner. Did he know something we didn't, that he wasn't really going to be the next prime minister, or why did he just drop out of the race?
So there's two things. First of all, there's a famous phrase in Conservative Party politics, he who kills the king will never wear the crown.
Mm.
So, and Boris is most directly associated with the public face of the Leave campaign. But there's something else going on here. The two most senior people on the Leave side were Boris, who is this very big, flamboyant guy, and has been since he went up to college at the age of 17 or 18, and he's been that personality. But then his partner in this was a guy called Michael Gove, who is the Justice Secretary, he's the Lord Chancellor, he's the head of the legal side of the government, and he is a whip-smart, really intelligent, intellectual, very, very good public speaker, but less showy, less flamboyant, adopted into a relatively, you know, middle-class background in the north of Scotland, and has made his way that way, but been in government in very senior levels. And what happened, I understand, is over the last couple of days, Michael looked at Boris and said, I don't think you're going to be able to lead this team. I don't think you'll be able to command a majority in the party. I'm not sure you're going to be committed enough to pulling out of the European Union.
Okay.
And then went public and said, I'm not supporting you.
Okay,
and
so
that left Boris without a plank to stand on.
All right, I understand that better now. My last question, we just have about a minute and a half or so. Ian, why can't Brits just hold another Brexit vote to make sure it's really what they want?
Pesky little thing called democracy.
But Cameron decided to hold the vote. Couldn't they, somebody just hold another vote? Say, you sure?
Yeah, so, you know, this is the biggest turnout in an election since 1992. More than 1.5 million people more voted to pull out. And this is something the British people haven't had to make a decision on in 40 years. And importantly, the Leave vote wasn't just from one side of the aisle. It wasn't the equivalent of Republicans believe one thing and Democrats believe another.
So are you saying if it was a really close vote, they might have held it again?
They might have. They might have. Possibly, if it'd been really close and just within one party supporters.
Oh.
But Labour Party supporters and Conservative Party supporters both voted in large numbers for Leave. It would be a really brave politician, and you know that's not necessarily a huge group of people,
yeah,
who would have turned and pushed that through the country.
Okay, I understand more now. Seattle expat Ian Toner with the investment managing consulting firm Verus. So he works here, and I know that, Ian, you were one of those voting to leave, and let's watch together as Seattleites now and watch how it all unfolds. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's KUOW's The Record. Sometimes people take unlikely paths to get where they're going. This is the story of an unlikely scholar, somebody who didn't learn to read until he was in fifth grade. Radioactive's Tori Zivkovich goes to see how he did it.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know.
It's okay, I'm looking for Leo Morales.
Yeah, it's
Knock, knock.
Hey,
are you Leo?
How are you?
Good. It
Good
took
to
me.
See you.
I was looking for Leo because I had heard about his research. Can you tell me basically what you do on a daily basis?
Oh, wow. What I do would sound very boring. I go to meetings. I talk to people.
Even though he
I
says that, Leo S. Morales loves his job,
proposals,
which I can't emphasize enough. He works for the University of Washington, researching minority health. As he talks, he leans forward, a short, gray-haired man in his 50s.
I mean, I found out I have a talent for and interest in research. What I found out is it's not that hard to create new knowledge if you have some tools.
But those tools were not so easily gained. They have taken Leo a lifetime. He was born here, but his parents were from Bolivia.
My father came first. He came actually out of high school.
Leo grew up in Seattle, only speaking Spanish, leaving him isolated when he started kindergarten, where he struggled to learn English alongside his mother. He didn't learn to read until fifth grade when he
spent a summer reading comic books because I couldn't read. So it just took time. It was learning another language. It was hard, but that's what I had to do, and so that's what I did.
School was more interesting after that. Then, one day, a friend from middle school told him he was going to go to Seattle Prep, a private school, instead of the local public high school.
I thought that was kind of a cool idea.
But his mother couldn't afford private school. By then, she was divorced and going to college herself. Then he got a break. Seattle Prep accepted him on a scholarship. It was here this curiosity really took off. Can you remember a project or anything that you did that really stands out?
I needed to do a report, and so I went and learned how a sewage treatment plant works. It smelled really bad. That was not the cool part.
It was disgusting down in the sewers, but they fascinated him.
Well, I just wondered how that actually all worked. So it was pretty neat.
He realized then that the world was full of mysteries waiting for him to solve. But it didn't last. The mystery lost its glamour during his first 2 years at the University of Washington.
So I think the first 2 years were probably the hardest when you're going through the general courses. You know, just it's kind of boring parts of it. It's just kind of like doing stuff you have to do to get through, but it's not really all that interesting.
He thought about dropping out.
You know, I spent a summer working in a warehouse.
Leo walked through the warehouse, climbing racks and pulling people's orders.
First, it seemed kind of cool.
But it quickly grew tiresome.
Then really thought about whether I wanted to be in college. A summer in a warehouse taught me I want to be in college.
He gave college a second chance. This time around, he found his path.
I focused on chemistry, and I really enjoyed it. With the thought of being a scientist, that's how I was led to healthcare. For me, it was a very natural extension to be interested in immigrant health.
From here, it was the next logical step when his research led him to the Latino health paradox. The paradox is based on data showing Latino immigrants live surprisingly long and healthy lives in the United States, despite often having low income and limited access to health care. Leo's family fit right into the paradox. He was curious and wanted to learn more, but it was not easy.
There are the realities of staying funded if you're a researcher, so that can be stressful.
Leo and some colleagues applied for a massive grant to study the paradox. It took them 3 months to write it. It was immediately rejected.
In fact, failures are really opportunities for learning, and that sounds cliche, but it's really, really true.
They rewrote the grant. This time, it worked.
This whole process is like chipping away at a bigger problem. And, you know, I saw that as work that was really helpful. I have focused on minority health. Minority communities have tended to be underserved and under-researched.
He knows how fortunate he is to be where he is today.
Just, this is the best, right? I'm getting paid to, like, find out some interesting stuff. You know, I was a curious person. I wanted to do this work, and I'm getting paid to do it. And I thought that was pretty incredible, you know. It's very privileged, you know. It's very, very fortunate.
Now he wants to give others the same chances he had.
And that's a really great thing. Young people who you know, may not have had all the opportunities coming along. And so, well, I guess I can do this. This is kind of cool.
To do that, he started pipeline programs that will open doors for future students. From Radioactive, this is The Story by Tori.
Tori made that story in KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media Workshop at the Seattle Public Library. Connect with Radioactive on Facebook. It's KUOW's The Record.